Good evening. It's Wednesday night, and it's 7 o'clock here on the West Coast. And this is our fourth class, I believe, on the Joy of Sacrifice. This is the Joy of Sacrifice by E.J. Gold. And as we're reading it, what we're finding, this is one of the first books that E.J. wrote, actually, an early publication. But as we're reading it and we've been through HBM, Human Biological Machine, and Practical Work on Self, and as we find our way back to Joy of Sacrifice, we find a rich depth in it that just is really paying off. So our work with the book is quite a nice meal. I want to emphasize a couple of things. We have a website, wingsofchaos.com. and Joy of Sacrifice, and you're going to find the various chapters, actually the various sacrifices there, and there's a vibrant conversation going on. And we get into it, if you're interested in other activities for the Institute, you can go to idhhb.com, and you'll see other workshops, activities on the weekend, and Barlow Safaris. Now, so we're going to start tonight. The real chapter that we're on tonight is actually the sacrifice of desire. Last week, we were actually worked with the sacrifice of comfort. And I'm actually going to go back to that chapter. That's actually on page 151 of the book is where it starts. And we had a varied conversation on that particular chapter, and the chapter subtitle is The Life of Austerity. But I wanted to address that for us. I wanted to indicate something and maybe help clarify how can we put this into our own life. The chapter is written in a way that is very appropriate to a monastic life. And if you are living in a monastic life, it is there's a lot of elements about that that are addressed in that particular chapter. So I started thinking, well, what can you do if you're in the world, so to speak, but you have a high desire for this particular kind of work? So what are some elements that you can start to introduce to your life that inject into your life this concept of life of austerity? And it begins to open up something, the life of the ascetic. You know, the church fathers, like in the Eastern Orthodox Church, and the great writings from the Philokalia, and all of the great Spanish mystics, they lived actual monastic lives of austerity. And of course, we see it in all the great religions. What about us? And I thought of a few things that may be helpful. And one thing is to inject into your life some habits that become important to you that, let's say, interrupt your normal flow of events. Here's an example. Let's say you made a determination that you're never going to eat food with unclean hands. What does that mean? That means that if you make a determination like that, and you go to a restaurant or you're eating at home, and you walk into the kitchen to grab something to eat, but you for instance, you didn't clean your hands, and you made that as a discipline. So you put that in the way of the normal habit that you have of just eating whatever or doing whatever whenever, right? And so let's say you do something like that. Suddenly you're going to notice some things about your life that are going to be very interesting. What are you doing now? What are you doing? You're introducing into the regular flow of life what I'm going to call moments of austerity.
Moments of austerity?
Moments of austerity that, and what happens when you're doing that? I'm trying to get us as a group here to start looking at things from the inside, not from the outside. And let's say that you go to do something like that, and you go to eat your, you know, just pick up your tuna sandwich off the counter, but you stop for a second. What has happened at that second? And that's what I'm interested in. What has happened at that one moment? It's caused you to work from a different place in yourself. And that's what we're trying to build up. And once you do that, it opens up really a teeny bit more of the space of the essential self. And that's what occurs. Another example. Let's say you hate that one and you're never going to do it. Ever. It is a good one. And let's say you make a determination, you're never going to wear street shoes in your house, nor is anybody else. Uh-oh, you have some real social problems there. Somebody comes over to visit you, they have their boots on, and you say, no shoes in the house. Uh-oh. But why do you do that, too? If you're creating something, okay? Practice with things like that. Maybe you decide that you're not going to touch your face or put your fingers near your mouth or things like that. And these are small things, but you inject small things like that into what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And we've interrupted the flow of where we normally go. And that's what we're looking for methods to do that, not so that we are following, let's just say, an external something, but that we're creating an internal atmosphere. There are whole groups of people that live like this, for instance, if you happen to be, like I'm considering, you happen to be a Hasidic Jew, you will never eat food that isn't kosher. Is this correct? You will never do certain things after sundown on Friday evening. You will begin certain things with a prayer. Let's say you're a Buddhist, and before every meal you dedicate that meal to the benefit of all beings everywhere. And that becomes, so what I'm saying is, maybe we're not living a life, a monastic life of austerity, but we inject certain things into our life that are continual reminders of that life of austerity. I'll put some of those up on that sacrifice as suggestions that people might want to do. You do what works for you. You do what works for you. Now, but also going back to that sacrifice of comforts, I want to read something that Susan Kester posted. I'm not sure if she's there or not tonight, but she said, as time goes on, I continue to watch my reactions to my sacrifice. I am finding that the sacrifices themselves are not so difficult. It is the leading up to a sacrifice that makes me squirm. It is the unknown, the fear of what life will be like. How can I possibly sacrifice something when I'm not even sure how it affects me? I guess that sacrificing comfort opens up space and energy in me that I can then do something else with. Now, all of the scholars here on the call, and I have, it is the leading up to a sacrifice that makes me squirm. What is that? What does that mean?
Well, she made her own commentary on it. What are the people that say on that?
What's happening there, guys? I learned this in practical work.
Hello.
Somebody has done, yeah, come on the line. But it's this idea of that leading up to a sacrifice is what makes me squirm. What did we talk about when we were talking about an HCM difficulty of approaching the waking state? That's where the fear occurs. If we're approaching the waking state, and at that moment, what is it that is squirming? It's the mechanical self. As soon as we start to acknowledge and own the fact that we are a mechanical being interacting with an essential self, something happens. Okay? And for that, we can go to the sacrifice 02 there on desires and see what Mark McGibbon has to say. He speaks about that in great detail.
Well, isn't what Susan's referring to, though, also a fear? It comes up, the fear that comes up, like of having to do with something undefined or something without scale, like, oh, my whole life could fall to pieces if I undertake this sacrifice.
Yeah, there's could, that. There's well, certainly
could,
that.
I could lose my job.
I could lose my job.
If I may say something too.
Yeah, go ahead, Sam.
That I think that is something very important happening at the same time, which is not only that we are breaking that mechanicality, that because usually every mechanical act through the whole day is pretty much of act of comfort for the machine.
That you should put on the website.
Okay.
And underline that.
Got it. So, but the other thing is that when we are trying to implement that for the despise of the machine,
yeah,
what we are training mainly here is of our act of will.
Okay. We're developing our will, and only by exercising our will do we start to find an ability to do these things, of which we're going to get into now in the chapter, the sacrifice before us, which is sacrifice of desire. Okay, so that is on page 164. I'm going to read a teeny bit first and then pose a couple of questions. But the sacrifice opens up, and E.J. Gold asks us this question. This is how it starts. The whole thing on this, it says, how is it possible to sacrifice one's desire without having first sacrificed one's comfort? Why is he asking that? Why did he start the chapter off with that? We've been through a little bit on the whole sacrifice of comfort, and now we walk into this next chapter, this next version called Sacrifice of Desire. But what he starts with, you had to do something on sacrifice of comfort to open up the door so you can even look at desire.
Simon just made a reference to this, that you're going all day long, your automaticity is to seek comfort, equilibrium, no stress, no discomfort is what the machine is looking for.
Correct.
Fulfillment, including fulfillment of gratifying desires. Right in there.
So when we're working with comfort and the sacrifice of comfort, we are immediately assaulted with are the limitations of our attention and the limitations of our will. How we can barely do it. We can barely do any of that stuff. We start to truly see our limitations as individuals. Thank God we start to see that. you actually start doing some of these exercises, you begin to see that limitation. And when you see that limitation, what starts to grow? What do you start to see? Only after having done so, which is attempt the sacrifice of comfort, does this second sacrifice become possible. In the sacrifice of desires, we become last in all things, making continual efforts to perform tasks without resentment, inner agitation, and particularly without pride in being of service. Now, how do you actually do this? I'd like to understand, how would you actually do something called become last in all things? How would you do that? Tell me how you would actually manifest that in your life, in a particular context that we're talking about.
Well, I could give you a few examples.
Okay.
Maybe, sometimes you get a social seating and food is being served and everybody goes there, try to go ahead. So you let that everybody serves first the meal and you're the last one. Obviously, you do that discreetly. Maybe seats, the example that I give you in the subway, you let everybody sit and you don't. If there is any seat left, then you get it. Maybe
right,
you don't.
You're getting a seat on the bus right away.
Right.
Yeah, there are different degrees of doing that, but I give you those examples in which you always try to serve yourself first, but on the contrary now, you just let everybody do that first and then you hang in on their back, in whatever situation that is. Obviously that your life don't depend on that, right?
Right. One of the things that came to mind for me was that when you're in a social environment like that, maybe hosting a dinner or being at a part of a dinner, is that you pay attention to everybody else there. Actually pay attention to them. And when you actually pay attention to them, you want to and help exercise the concept of hospitality and serve those individuals. You serve those individuals, and then in that context, you are last. You're not last from an ego point of view. You're last from a true service point of view. Just a thought I had on that comment, on that statement, last in all things. Pride of service is without doubt the most insidious potential trap in this level, and one who does not watch for it and fears attention is doomed to continue to make this sacrifice for a long time. Now, we have to see the context that the author is giving us here. In the next paragraph, one may perform menial tasks for the community, such as maintaining the fire, which is an important job, which is kept continually during the periods of sacrifice. One may also clean and maintain the unpleasing parts of the household, such as the kitchen, toilet, dining room. These areas may occasionally be scrubbed down from our top to bottom every hour or two. One shows humility in all things and has the least importance in self or in work. One must outwardly at least be respectful of all members of the community on whatever level they may be. At least we can do that. At least we can do that. One must accept all corrections of one's attitudes, behaviors, or actions, whether true or not in one's own opinion, and one is polite to the extreme, without being groveling. One shows courtesy to others by recognizing the essence in them. That is to say, one always bows deeply whenever addressed by another member of the community of work. One does not speak unless spoken to, and one never comments or complains. At this all-important stage, one seeks help rather than offering it. Here one functions as a caretaker to the personal needs of others, but not for oneself. one is more concerned with the other members of the community, that the other members of the community may do their work without having to worry over daily necessities, and tries to make their lives easier by eliminating ordinary obstacles for them by doing for them all manner of unpleasant or menial things. One serves the obligatory sacred observances by cleaning and caring for the area where the said observances are being held. If one studies this function closely, one can see that it literally requires one to work with profound attention. So, how do we do this? You're not living, most of us are not living in a community where there are other community members who serve in this way, where they're not guests coming to the community to serve in this way. So how would you implement this in your life where you are, in Colorado, Denver, in Toronto, in Seattle, in Austin, Texas, in Riverside, California? How would you manifest this attitude in the work you're doing, where you're doing it? Okay? You're here.
I've been doing it by cooking for myself.
And who is this?
This is Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Hi there.
Greetings. Okay.
So my spouse had some dental surgery and can't eat anything, so I've taken it on to make various soups and try to make it as appetizing and take that worry off of him.
Perfect.
The service.
But and the effort there, of course, is how to do that with greater and greater attention, so that every, you know, to be attentive to every morsel, in a sense, that is sufficient for his situation. Not that you can say, hey, I made you dinner, you're done, eat, you know. And so the exercise becomes an inner exercise. Perfect example. Perfect example. Anyone else? Perfect. Very good. Go ahead, Ivan.
Come forward now or forever hold your peace.
What if you're living by yourself? How would you do such a thing?
The cat.
Cat. Or dog. People, a couple of people have dogs, too.
Couldn't you bring austerity into your living state that you were recommending?
Yes.
In regard to the first session. So humility, can you bring humility into your living state?
Well, let's say that, what if you cleaned your kitchen and your living room? If you have such a thing, if you're not necessarily living in a car, for instance, and you cleaned it in such a way that you're cleaning it to host the guests that will be coming. We don't know who that guest is, but when they come, the space is prepared in a sense. And our work effort there, we're working to create a sanctity of space. We're creating a environment that those that might come to visit us can sense that sanctity of space, and they can see what it is. They can feel it. It's tangible that the workspace operates in that way. And I would say that there are certain people, and I think that there are some spaces where I know that if you go into, you can feel that the person has done that form of work. Is this right, Molly? Yeah. Are there comments that you want to share?
Some comments online?
Why don't you share a couple?
Here,
I got something to read over here, if you will.
Yeah, go ahead.
Praying Mantis says, clean up garbage in the neighborhood.
Okay.
Singhawk suggests, put your essential self first and then your personality second.
Very interesting.
DeAngelo says, visiting my aged friend in assisted living centers and listening attentively to all their stories. That's DeAngelo. Pat World says, is being married for 41 years a service? I think so. I think it's a great service.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Jan Flower says, I live in a work community and I take it upon myself to assist with whatever I need in the community. I assist with whatever it needed in the community house. I try to do this without being attached to the work effort.
Okay.
And, Lost Horizon house cleaning has work.
No, that's interesting. Whose comment is it about a group house? Who is that?
The Jan Flower seems to be working in a community group.
A community
or live. She lives in a community. So, and
about this. Go ahead, Simon.
She says that I live in a work community and I take it up on myself to assist with whatever it needed in the community house.
Yeah, see, I would say I've had that experience. What this chapter brings to mind, I've cleaned floors and I've cleaned bathrooms and certainly cleaned kitchens and so on, and I've done it in a work community, and then I'm thinking about is how that carries over as a practice, let's say, into my home. Let's say now I'm not living in a work house in the same way. I'm living in a group house, so, you know, I'm a householder. So, but I, you know, it seems to me that I can carry over, like, my willingness to do more than my fair share of chores, let's say, in the house that I live in, is, you know, that I find that having done this in a community house or, you know, in a group work situation, it's made me more oriented towards collaborating with the people I live with, you know, or just helping out in the household. But I think that in doing those sort of tasks, I don't have the issue of wanting to be rewarded for my great work of humility, you know, by doing household chores. It's more like I catch myself, I have to keep an eye on. I have to observe myself and see if I'm actually feeling resentment, if I'm having an emotional reaction to doing work that I think somebody else should be doing, or that I'm doing more than my share of chores at home.
So for you,
so that, because that's a fidget, you know, that's a habitual emotional response. Oh, like, why do I have to do this vacuuming, or why do I have to clean this kitchen? But, you know, I think that what I'm saying is that the monastic sort of version of that, which is what EJ is describing here, I think that that can carry over, you know, into another living situation. It can be applied in another living situation, possibly even if you're living alone, like you were saying.
Correct. It can. It certainly can. If you've created the will that creates the inner space from which that kind of work flows. In other words, you live in a community group house and, you know, you work with others, you do have resentment, you do have pride.
Right.
All of those things
come up
over and over and over again. Why didn't she do his work as hard? Who is she not to do the kind of work that I was doing?
Right.
Why can he, who is this guy that never ever vacuumed before? And I vacuum it all. Can't you see that it's a mess? And so on and so forth. Or
right.
you do things, and for, you know, I lived with somebody for years, and, you know, I'd go out and buy food for him, and I had pride at that. And resentment.
Pride and resentment both.
Okay, so those, it's embracing and realizing that that's going to go on. And where does that come from? That comes from the ego and the pride in the mechanical self. It doesn't come from the true ground of humility.
That
humility is ground. It's being grounded. It's of the ground. It's like of the earth.
Mm.
That's its etymology. It's of the earth. We're not looking for measure. And when we look for measure, what have we done? We've gone away from exercising. What was the person, the name of the person again that lived in a group house? Young Flower. So Young Flower is sitting there making these efforts and has these issues with regards to ego, resentment, self-pity, everything you can think of, but nevertheless persists. And to the extent that you put in what is called profound attention,
right, that helps.
If you put in, you don't have time for the other stuff, because when you're sitting there and you're sweeping, and are you sweeping so just so you can tell everybody else you swept the kitchen? Or are you sweeping because that's the appropriate thing to do for the sanctity of the place, space in which you're working? And so you get that little extra something in the corner, and you work like this because it's the proper way to maintain the space. If you do it like that, you can't, in a certain way, you can't wait to get back to sweeping the next time, because you want to do it. Why do you want to do it? Because you love exercising yourself in that manner. And that's the beauty of what we're talking about here. Now, I've got a question for everybody here.
Okay.
Ivan, and I'm going to start with you.
Okay.
I thought this chapter had something to do with something called sacrifice of desires, but all I see is this stuff about humility and profound attention, and where does it talk about sacrifice of desires? Is this a misprint? Maybe it's a misprint. Anybody help me out here?
No, not in this book, sorry. This is dated 1997.
I think if I may say something to that.
Yes.
Is that first, yes, we are, the first step is that we are sacrificing some kind of a desire. Whatever the machine wants to do, let's say, maybe it doesn't want to clean, maybe it doesn't want to do the last job on the line. But suppose that you find the will to do that, so you sacrifice that desire and you go and you do it. But the second stage, going farther or underneath the exercise, is that observation that you don't find vanity in that exercise. And that is the aspect of humility that comes after you sacrifice that desire.
Okay, I'm going to read something, the last half of what Mark McGibbon wrote. He's talking about this great effort he's putting in, and I mean it in all sincerity, because we recall
the recording,
the mountain that this man climbed for the benefit of all of us students. And he's worked a great deal of time, many, many hours, and then he continues and he says, the next day I showed up for work as needed, and saw a note on one of my cassette players. The note was from EJ, and it turned everything right side up for me for a while. It read, high attention, high indifference, do, dare, It is my experience that attention cannot develop past a certain point without the component of impartiality. I hope this is of use to my fellow students when they find themselves between a rock and a machine. And your Eggers comes back and says, please give examples, show how without impartiality attention is limited. So what is Mark saying here, and what does he mean by high indifference, or high attention and high indifference?
You know, I think both are very well taken. What Mark said, you know, notice actually DJ's commentary on the work that Mark is doing.
Correct.
Or his encouragement to Mark.
Yeah.
And then I think that Sandra Eggers' question is also worth taking up. But I mean, yeah, this high indifference is the important element because, you know, what this chapter here, again, having not read this for years and now reading it again, okay, just reading these statements, it's reminding me that, you know, even in the group house, like the situation that Youngflower is talking about, let's say, you know, in the time when I was living in a group house or working in a group house, and sure, I would do the most menial tasks, but if I was, and I this is what I thought, I don't think David said he didn't read my post, but I posted something about this just a little earlier today, that, you know, if I'm working for other people, but I'm walking around saying, hey, look how humble I am. Look at my humility. I deserve a medal for this humility. Reward me. Praise me. You know, where's my praise? This is very mechanical. And mechanical is not the word. It's comical. Is what it is.
But
it's very hilarious. But it is a situation. It is the way we find ourselves. But the high indifference is the element that's missing there, because it's like saying. For me, I can look at it from a point of view of aesthetics. It's like, why not be able to just do the work for the aesthetic value of it, be absorbed in it with high attention, and do everything with appropriate aesthetics. Do everything
okay.
As David was saying, as it should be done.
As it should be done.
And I can do that. And does it matter if anybody's watching me or not? No, actually. Does it matter if anybody... acknowledges me or
even
not.
Even knows about it.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, this other situation, like, funny, this is another thought came to mind. When I walk around, like, I work part-time at a community college. Hey, when I walk around the community college campus, or when I go back and forth in my car in the parking lot, you know, if I see somebody's cup that's tossed around or somebody drops a bottle or something like that, I pick it up and I throw it in the recycling bin or I throw it in the litter bin or something. And, you know, I'm not doing that to be rewarded. You know, I'm not doing it points or anything like that. It just seems appropriate to me to clean the area up. But
yeah.
What strikes me about that is, like, if I'm getting my mechanicalness about this, if I were to come upon somebody or let's say be chatting with one of my colleagues or with students, let's say, and start haranguing somebody about why are people so messy and why do they throw this trash around and how come people are irresponsible? And why do people like me have to walk around and pick up the trash after them? That would be, to me, that would be mental.
Ivan and David, can you add something? Because there is a lot of question marks in the word used impartiality.
Yeah.
In this case, what do you think it is impartiality applied to these examples?
Let me speak to that a little bit. When you are working with attention, let's say Youngflower, when she's doing this work in the group house, or Susan is doing the work of preparing these meals, or Ivan is, you know, doing this or that, and suddenly you attach your ego to it. What's happened then is that the mechanical, historical personality has harvested that effort for the ego. It's taken that effort and it's taken it and put it in the ego bank.
Mm-hmm.
Only when you can stay utterly impartial, where every sweep of the broom is your full effort. I think there might be some musicians on. I'm not sure if the Doses are there, but I don't know because I'm not a musician. But if when they're involved with playing music, they're so involved with the concept of their musical voices interacting in a certain way, they're not thinking of the external. If they are, then they're losing something too.
Well, no, this is a good example. I was going to try to come up with examples that were not just menial work, let's say, but what about intellectual, what about aesthetic work or intellectual work? I mean, and the music is a good example. I mean, I think that to play music with EJ, you need to develop impartiality.
You have to develop,
indifference, because it's better, much better, it goes better not to worry about how I sound, for example. You know,
so,
I need to be paying attention to how you sound, and especially how we sound.
And how I communicate to you in that sound.
Yeah, well, what is it that we're doing? The point is, what are we doing together in collaboration, and not what is my solo sounding like?
And we know that that occurs too, but that's different than we're talking about. So let's say that...
This is Mark in Winnipeg.
Hey, Mark. Greetings.
Yeah, with respect to that comment that I made, I was talking about impartiality to my own personal despair with respect to brain freeze, just not being able to function anymore. And I think that note it did for me was to see my personal suffering and to be completely impartial to it so I could just continue to do my job and get through that difficult point. The next day you show up for work and you just continue to sweep or do the tapes or cook the food. But it's that personal despair or lack of focus that to actually sacrifice.
And even that you set aside for the sake of the holy effort of impartial attention. Because when you are in that effort of that form of attention, and if Susan is making this meal, this impartiality to the results, whether it's liked or not liked, but just that with as much effort as she can put into it, or young flowers cleaning the washroom with perfect effort, where is that attention and partiality residing? It's residing and coming from the essential self. At that point, there's an inner mood that is occurring. That inner mood is perfectly aligned with the concept of humility, because you're up against the vastness of the absolute at that moment when you're cleaning that little counter space. And your effort and your placement at that site internally, if you can stand there, that becomes the antidote to personal desire. So being in that space is what allows us to get on a different track than the track of desire. You cannot overcome desire directly. But you can live a life in a different manner in which the desires are not the temple upon which you base your life. So rather, they're there. But as Mark is saying, you have the opportunity. You can just go back to work. And you can just go back to work in this manner.
Well, I just like to have Mark repeat this. At that time, Mark, when you received that communication, What did high indifference mean to you in that note?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
No, I didn't hear what you said.
Yes. Could you rephrase the question again?
Okay, yeah, can you hear me? I'm just wondering, what exactly did you interpret high indifference to mean in relation to your editing job?
Oh, with respect to indifference? Just a second.
Turn the sound on your computer down, please.
Yeah, okay. The indifference that he was referring to, that he was seeing in me, or lack of indifference, I should say, my frustration, my lack of concentration, my isolation. I was more isolated from the community. I was more reclusive. I was left. I was leading into a brain freeze. I was recoiling into myself because of the enormity of what I said to myself I could do. And then also there was a fear that I was just basically going to crap out. Everyone in the community would know, hey, there's the tapes. Where's Mark? He's downing Pfizer at the grocery store. So there's a lot of things involved with being too. And that's a partial list of.
Here's what I'm asking. Is that, did the high indifference mean that you would just let all of that run and do your job anyway? Or did the high indifference mean that you would do your job without all of that distraction? You know, you would not experience all of that.
No, I think the company was talking about was high attention. And if you had high attention coupled by indifference, all of those things just dropped away. The machine could not generate that level of negativity in a continuous way with the presence of high indifference and high attention.
Right.
So it was just, from my standpoint, a matter of perseverance.
Yes.
And remaining faithful.
It becomes a method to get through these complexities of the personality, which is to perform the act with high attention and high indifference. It's like you can always go there as an antidote to these psychological states we have. I recall very, very clearly. Okay, hang on one second, and then I'd like to hear it, Molly. I recall when I first came to the Institute some 20-some years ago. When I first got here, after just a few months, I was thrown into a particular situation, which you may or may not remember, Ivan, that was very tumultuous. And it lasted for a number of months, and it was very, very difficult to operate. So we'd have these giant group dinners, you know, 30, 40 people at dinner, and each day give a talk. And after that, there was this mountain of dishes. I would volunteer to do the dishes because it was something I knew I could do. So it was a moment of clarity that I can do, and I knew that effort I could put in that manner, cleaning these dishes very well because they were for the community for the next meal. And it was an effort I could put in and maintain a track of solidity during this moment of tumult. And Molly said,
David,
that question. Yeah.
That's exactly how with the tape. I saw in a moment of clarity that I could do tapes. I had experience in audiovisual in Winnipeg for many years.
Yep.
And I saw that was of use. It was an open door, and that was debilitating. No better, no worse than dishes or sleeping, just another to the community.
There you go. Simon, is there a question there for me?
I got one for you here. Praying Mantis says that if you can restate what the antidote for desire was.
Okay, good. All right, so Praying Mantis wants to know, what's the antidote for desire? So once again, and this is, I think, because I'm puzzled by why does EJ start this chapter out in the way he does? And why are we talking about the power of attention rather than desire? And for me, the answer is that when we are in the place of making effort with great attention and high indifference to the outcome, how we're viewed, without any concern for our personal pride, when we are doing that kind of effort, it is creating a certain alchemical change within us, and that alchemical state is the antidote to desire. Desire has to do with pride, has to do with me, has to do with me first and me only. And if you are truly doing efforts like that, and I think that Young Flower, she's got a great opportunity working in a group house, when you go to sweep or vacuum the house, if you're just doing that with great attention and high indifference, for the sanctity of the altar space, really, you are creating something in you, and in that ground that you are creating, there is no room and no ground for desire. Personal desire in the way that we're talking about. Does that help a little bit, Praying Mantis?
Praying Mantis, are you in the line?
No, I don't think so.
No. He's just on the computer.
Yes, he did.
Okay, good. So that's the practice here. That's the practice called the sacrifice of desire. That's the practice called sacrifice of desire. And the subchapter is the subheading. It's life of humility. We have to think on these things deeply. We have to work with that. And this is a huge area. This, why does it say humility? Now, if you want to work more along what it means, because what Susan and Mark and Youngflower are talking about, if I may, those are forms of prayer. And the prayer is offered up just as a cleansed vessel is all. You're not doing it because I am the one that's doing the prayer. You're offering it up because you place the effort of will to set your personal pride aside, and because your power of attention is so strong, there's no place for that kind of personal pride. It's just your own effort, and that's the seat of humility. That's the seat of humility, is that kind of effort. At that point, and Mark knows this, Susan can, I can feel her recalling right now her efforts of making that dinner, and I know that Young Flower has done this kind of work. And you're sitting there, and those moments of true service create something in us that is a small little step called humility. Little teeny bit of ground that we can step on. And we keep coming back to it, and it gets stronger and stronger, and we know once again how to get there. And part of the element of how to get there is the power of our own attention in every act we do. In every act we do right now, Am I doing this act right now for a form of pride? Or am I doing this act because this is the best I can conceive at the moment how to do it? I recall in my dishwashing days, which I miss in a certain way, I recall being anxious to get back to doing those dishes because they gave me a chance to exercise that kind of attention yet again. And that's what I'm talking about, and we're going to look for those in our daily lives. So if you can find another one, an example, and Young Flower, if you feel like it, going on the website wingsofchaos.com, sacrifice, under Joy of Sacrifice, and you'll see Sacrifice 02. If you want to write a teeny bit about the particular work that you do, that's going to be very, very, very helpful. And Susan, the meal concept is great, and you can all go there and read Mark's post. He has two posts that are very strong, very, very strong, and don't miss the second one he posted, which is very good. So we just have a couple of minutes, but wow is all I can say.
Yeah.
David, this was the best one yet.
You know what? My daughter is now 24 years old, and every birthday she has, I say, this has been the best year yet. Mm-hmm. And you know what, Mark? This is the best one yet.
Oh, I'm contemplating. I'm sitting with this idea that there are no desires specified in this chapter, and I think that it is very interesting that obviously very deliberately chose not to open up this bag, you know, this Pandora's box, because, I mean, my desires and her desires and your desire, everybody's going to have different desires, and the desires are endless. I think this is what the Buddhists say.
They are endless.
The desires are infinite and so on.
But they
so
can
you,
be...
What are you talking about? What you've described is you're just sidestepping the whole issue. You're going to the second stream.
You're going to a different stream altogether,
yeah.
And from there we have clarity. But more importantly, we're creating a foundation that we can stand on called humility. And we're very fortunate because next week, on Wednesday at the same time, 7 o'clock, we're going to sacrifice our habits. So that's going to be easier, right?
Habits.
Life?
Habits.
Of the contrary.
Who needs them?
So thank you very much for coming again. And I really appreciate the post that you're putting up there. It helps us, and it helps everyone that comes behind us to read this book. So thank you for coming, and I look forward to seeing you next week when we're going to face the sacrifice of habit. Good night.
Thank you. Goodbye, Ivan and David. Thank you very much. Good to see you.
Thank you, Simon.
We'll see you next.